G'day and welcome to another segment of the Build Me a Brewery podcast. My name is Chris Hayton. Now, I hope the previous segment on brewery consulting and quality management was informative and helpful to you all. It was in my own plans. We now move into a much anticipated segment on the podcast series, and that is brewery equipment sourcing. Now, another four-episode segment that includes conversations with guests from both here in Australia and overseas, all talking about brewery equipment and the important considerations when going through this important process of your brewery build. Our first episode of the segment, I sit down with Neil Playfoot from Asian Beer Network. Now, Neil, he has over 20 years industry experience working in both brew pubs, production breweries, on a wide range of brewing systems across many different countries, including the UK, France, Bermuda, and now China. Currently based in China, Neil now provides brewery consulting services and can act as a man on the ground for people outside of mainland China for sourcing their equipment. This chat with Neil was so informative and gave me so many different ideas and perspectives on when thinking about picking the right location, how to set up a brewery, and considering the different brewery system arrangements to maximize production output. So we'll kick off part one of the brewery equipment sourcing segment with my chat with Neil Playfoot from the Asian Beer Network. Welcome, Neil, to the Build Me a Brewery podcast. Thanks for coming on, mate.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for the invitation to come and speak with you, and I'm looking forward to it today.
Just to give the audience, an idea of how we sort of got in contact, we've been talking for the last few weeks via LinkedIn, and I've been following some of your content that you've been putting on about your brewery consulting business, Asian Beer Network, sure. And you know, and even your website. You've got a very detailed blog, and I've been pretty impressed with some of the information you're sharing. And I thought, well, why not have you on, mate, and share your experience and stories of the brewing industry? So I have given the audience a little bit of a heads up about you, but I guess to dive in a bit more about Neil and what you do in the brewing industry, are you able to give us a bit of idea about your career background and maybe your craft beer roots?
Yeah, sure. Well, I started out as a brewer in the UK. I left high school, 17, and decided to get into the brewing industry, basically because I like beer. I thought, why not just do something that you love? So I rode off to lots of different companies, and eventually there was a brewery in London that offered me the chance to make beer, just starting at the bottom, cleaning tanks, working on the bottling line, and it was called Freedom, and they were at the time the only German lager, well, Pilsner style lager microbrewery in the UK. So unlike a lot of UK brewers, I instead of doing ales, my background is in lager. I still today like a really good Pilsner just from my background of making lager.
I'm actually a big, sorry to interrupt you there, but yeah, massive Pilsner fan as well. I know that they're a lot harder to brew than the average pale ale or IPA. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah, it's just, it takes a little bit more, well, it takes a lot of love, you know, talking to the beer. I call myself a bit of a beer whisperer. And yeah, I think if you can make a good Pilsner, it's a good indication that a brewery knows what it's doing. From there, I kind of got headhunted to go and work for a couple of brew pubs in London, started making real ales. Was there for a couple of years and then got the chance to travel abroad. So as we've been talking in our discussions, I've sort of become like a jobbing career brewer and traveled around and been lucky to brew in a number of places, from Portugal to Bermuda to Hong Kong. And now I've settled in China, and this is what I'm doing over there, just doing some brewing, the brewing consulting work.
Perfect. You mentioned already, you know, you started your beer drinking days at an early age, and so Pilsner is one of your favourites. Any favourite breweries, either in China or UK or across the world, what would you say would be maybe your top two or three?
I suppose one beer really sticks in my head, and maybe one of the original beers that really got me into it. It was a small company called Exmoor Ales, and they made this, I can't even remember the name now, but it was like Brewer's Gold, and it was just a really simple pale ale, just a little bit hoppy. But I sometimes think like the simpler beers are the ones I kind of enjoy, like it's just the right balance of hopness, you know, sweetness from the malt. And I was like, this is really, really good. And I was like, I mean, how do you come up with a recipe like that? And it kind of just got me thinking about beer in general. And from there, I, as I say, got thinking about getting into the brewing industry. Otherwise, I don't know, it changes quite a lot. I'm a pretty big fan of Belgian beers as well. So like Rochefort 10 is probably another one of my favorites. You know, if I ever see that in the shop, we can actually get that in China in quite a few different places now. So it's also a nice treat every time I see that on a shelf and I'll pick that up.
Yeah, we don't get a lot of Belgian beers over in Australia. I haven't been exposed to too many. Slowly, like we're starting to get craft beer and specialty bottle stores that do stock them. Bucket Boy's been one of them over here in my area. I hear so much about Belgian beers, but I can't say I've had a whole lot of experience with them. And I feel like it's sort of a gap in my, I guess, tasting of good beers. So,
are there any Australian brewers like making like Belgian style beers? Can you get like some triples over there? Or
yeah, you can. I don't know if they're more imported over here. No breweries that come to mind that are actually Australian based that are making them that I know of. I'm sure there's a number of listeners that are probably saying, there's this brewery. But, you know, there's probably some, I guess, inspiration styles. You know, there's a few breweries over here that are doing like a lot of German styles. I mean, who isn't? Mm-hmm. And, but yeah, I've had the odd triple and, but yeah, I'm keen to taste a lot more actually, because I hear so many people saying that, you know, they've been inspired of getting into the brewing industry and Belgium has been a big source of that.
I mean, yeah, I mean, with the whole like the history they've got, I mean, when you look at like doing like cool ships, because that's another article I'm looking to write soon. I mean, like some of the big breweries, when they're doing their lambic beers, when you look into the whole tradition and the history, I mean, they're keeping to the same brewing techniques that they've been using for like 300-400 years. And I can see how it's an inspiration for myself and definitely an inspiration for lots of brewers out there for sure.
Well, I guess moving on to the bread and butter of our conversation. And as I was mentioning, this episode is going to form part of our equipment sourcing segment. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to, I guess, get a sense more about the services you offer, Neil, with Asian Beer Network, and also diving into a bit more about some important considerations around equipment sourcing, especially over in China or overseas in that Asian market where people tend to seem to go a lot for their equipment. So just to, I guess, kick off this part of the segment, tell us a bit more about Asian Beer Network and the services you offer, mate.
Yeah, sure. So Asian Beer Network is something I set up because what I was finding is more and more breweries around the world were wanting to source their equipment from China. I mean, the biggest pull is it can be like 30 to 50, maybe even a larger percentage cheaper than if you were going to buy it in the West from Europe or elsewhere. So I was like, a lot of people, they wanted to come to China. And when I looked in the forums, a lot of people like, which equipment manufacturers would you recommend? How do I go about it? People had read stories about, you know, they purchased equipment and they never seen the equipment, or the equipment arrived and it wasn't up to spec, or, you know, the welds weren't hygienic. And I was like, because I first came to China in 2010 and I've been fortunate enough to brew for a few different breweries and built up my contacts, I was like, you know, I could probably help other people, you know, source their equipment from China, you know, even if they just want to come and talk to me, I'm always happy to speak to any. You can send me some emails, ask me questions. And obviously now with COVID-19, it's actually particularly hard to get into China from the outside. So what I try and do is, you know, if somebody comes to me, they want to order some equipment from China, I've got a series of questions. I'll ask them, try and find out what their needs are, what their budget is, and then I can go out, speak to some manufacturers that I know work really well, because I've obviously been there, worked on some of that equipment, or I have other people that have that equipment in China and brewing on it. I can get you some tenders, like break it down, tell you, you know, this is what they do, this is what this person does, and give them an idea of choices they are. And then if they narrow it down to one, two, or three, I can go up to the factories, you know, I can take videos, I can take pictures and stuff. So basically I try and give them the best way of choosing the equipment and feel like they're really included, and then use to make a decision, then hopefully go through the whole purchase phase and then work with the client and the manufacturer. And so everybody's obviously in the conversation throughout the whole process through fabrication, and then eventually have a final visit up for signing off before it's shipped across to wherever it's going.
Mm. So Neil, when should an aspiring brewery owner start focusing on what equipment they'll need in the planning phase?
I would say once you know what type of brewery you want to be it a production brewery, a farm brewery, or a brew pub, then first off, find your location. Once you have your location, that will determine the size of equipment you have, depending on floor height, how much floor space you have, how much floor space you need to you have for your sales, and if you're a brew pub, if you're going to also have the kitchen, and then try and find the right balance. And then you'll know, like for a brew pub, how many people you can fit in there, and then that will determine the size of your brewery. And then once you have the size of the brewery, then you can go on to thinking about what equipment you need.
Mm. And I guess that's a good lead into the type of equipment or a list of equipment that a brewery needs. Are you able to go through some of the core bits of equipment that, you know, a new brewery needs?
Sure. So obviously when it comes to brewing equipment and brewing machinery, it can become open-ended. But if you're starting out, I would say obviously you need a mill. And then if your system is over 10 hectolitres, then I would think about actually having some kind of malt delivery system, either like some kind of auger, because that goes into a grist hydrator and then goes into your mash tun. It just helps with consistency of the mash. But anything under 10 hectolitres, you can probably still do that by hand with a mash paddle. You also need your brew house. You usually start with a minimum of a two-vessel system. But depending on the type of brewery you have, you might end up having more, up to a five or even six-vessel system. Then you also need a heating system. I would always opt for steam if you have the possibility over electric. I mean, lots of people do use electric, but sometimes you can have like caramelizing points burning, scorching on the elements. Then you need, obviously, the heat exchanger. So when the wort is going to fermenter, it's the you use the heat exchanger to chill it to the temperature for the fermentation. And then obviously you need some fermentation tanks. I usually say to people, get some double-sized fermenters, because you're going to have two or three beers that are going to sell in greater volume than the other ones. And if you set up and decide on your brewery system correctly, you can do two brews in one day. And like for example, in China, most breweries, up to 50% of their beers that they sell would be like a German Hefeweizen. So everybody always double batches those just to make sure they can keep up with sales. Always have one bright tank, even if you're not filtering your beer to clean it. It's always good to have a bright tank. If you want to maybe mix it with some adjuncts or with some fruits later on, I like to put my fruit additions into the fermenter and then push the whole thing across to a bright tank just to get a proper homogeneous mix. And if you're above 200 liters for your brew house, it's quite good to have a CIP unit, because it will allow you to reuse a lot of your key cleaning chemicals and will actually pay for themselves over quite a short period, especially if you're buying from China. Even if you're looking to open a brew pub and you want to use serving tanks, you're going to have some kegs, because once the tank starts to become empty, it doesn't make sense to have maybe a couple hundred liters or be 20% full. That's a good time to keg off your beer and then put some fresh beer into there. So it's always nice to have a keg cleaner. It doesn't have to be big, even if it's only just doing like 20 kegs an hour. A, you're going to use less chemicals, and B, it's just less man hours. I mean, depending on the size of your operation, I mean, 70% of your time in a brewery is usually cleaning, and you don't want to spend in too much time cleaning kegs. So if you've got a little system that can do that, where you can press a button and can be doing other stuff while it's cleaning, it's really useful. And then even if you're a production brewery or a small brewery, maybe you want a packaging line. But even if you're just a small brew pub, it's worth having like a crowler that you can take beers straight off the dispense and then fill them, so people can do takeaways as well. You'll be surprised at how much people, when they have a couple of beers, they want to carry on drinking when they get home. And it can actually pay for itself pretty quickly, and it gives an option. And also, you know, if people want to do parties, they can come in, you can off some beers and then send them away. So yeah, mill, brew house, heating, heat exchanger, fermentation, a one bright tank. Oh, a transfer pump is really good to have. Sometimes you can use that for the CIP, but also just pushing beer from one tank to another. A keg cleaner and some kind of packaging, even for a crowd or for a brew pub or a small bottling line if you're a production brewery.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's a great list there, and some of the thoughts around the heating systems. I've not heard of all the differing pros and cons of steam versus electric and direct fire or anything like that. So yeah, it's interesting to know all the pros and cons of all that, and some of the little, I guess, industry tricks around trying to improve, you know, efficiencies and all that. Like, you know, you sent me some information offline about, you know, all the different differences between two vessels, three, four, five vessel systems. So, you know, that's really opened my eyes up. So I guess leading into our next question about the various types of brewing systems out there on the market, are you able to go through the differing systems and I guess the advantages of each?
Yeah, so I'd recommend starting out with a brew pub, because when you've made the beer, you've got automatic in-house sales. When you get into the production brewing game, you've got to think about distribution. In a brew pub, you usually have a two or three vessel system, depending on the space you have. And even if you want to start a two vessel system, which is usually a combined mash tun and lauter tun, and then a combined kettle and whirlpool, I mean, you can make good beer on it. It just means that if you, like, for example, when I was talking about doing double brews, like of your biggest sellers, if you have the room and you have the budget, it's always good to go for a three vessel system, because obviously you're going to mash in. Basically, I'd have a combined mash lauter, and then I'd have a kettle and then a whirlpool. So it just means that you have the chance to do each stage. So you can do your lauter and mash, you do your boil, and then you do your whirlpool. By having three vessels, it just means it can move through each interval system quicker if you have a two vessel system. So that will probably cut your time for double brewing by up to 2, 3, maybe 4 hours. So when you think about that, if you're doing 2 to 3 brews a week, you're almost getting back one extra day of to do other stuff, cellaring, filtering, or whatever. So I would always recommend, if you have the chance, to go to a three vessel system if you're in a brew pub. And if you can't, then what you can do is speak with the equipment supplier, or if you're using a consultant or you're having somebody else help you, and then give yourself the opportunity in the design to be able to add on a piece of equipment easily later on. Because for a lot of people, they think it's the cellar space that where the bottleneck can be. But for many people, it can be the brew house. By adding one or two extra tanks, you can actually increase your throughput through the brew house by 50 to 100%. You know, if you were to go 500-liter brewery and then you had to buy, say, a 10-hectoliter brewery, by adding extra vessels to your original brew house, it might be allow you to increase your volume without spending on a new brewery again. You can maybe only spend an extra 30% of your original capital investment. And then when you get up to production breweries, some of them will have 4, 5, or even 6 vessel systems. So the idea of that is you can do up to 6, 8, maybe even 10 brews in a 24-hour shift. Wow. So the idea is when you mash in, and then you'll take it to the lauter tun. And then obviously you can lauter then going into a kettle. But obviously, as you move on to the next stage, it enables you to start the next brew. And it doesn't necessarily mean you have to brew the same beer all the way through. When you're doing those 6, 8, 10 turns, you can actually, I usually would start, say, with a lighter brew, and then you maybe going into those darker brews. So you can do multiple brews and different styles all in one day. So depending on what you want out from your brewery, depending on the number of vessels you can have, it can really give you some flexibility and make it sort of more dynamic, so you can make different styles quickly and then get them to market.
And just so I am clearing this up in my mind. So when you're moving your beer from one vessel to the next, say, for instance, you've got a three-vessel system, you've just finished your mash, you've moved it to the kettle, and what you're saying is at that point you can then get a CIP in on that mash, give it a good clean out, and start the next mash. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. So, I mean, it's nice to give it a really good clean out. That's what I'm saying. Always maybe just go from lighter to darker. Because, like, say if you're doing the same brew over again, you will clean it out, but you don't have to give it really serious clean. You're just pretty much getting rid of all those grains. And then, because obviously at that point, you know, you're still going to boil the beer later on. So, yeah, you just literally allowed you to go through processes much quicker because you're moving the process along by one tank at a time, allowing you to start the next step quicker, rather than if you have a two vessel system, you have to do your mash and then you're doing your louter in the same system. But if you have a mash and a louter, you're doing your mash steps whilst you're also doing your louter from your louter to your whirlpool, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. Yeah. I was just curious to know, you know, what you're doing once you've moved that mash over to the kettle, you know, and you're saying start the next brew, what process are you doing to sort of like the cleaning and sanitizing of that mash tun to start the next brew? And you've just answered that for me. So no, I've never even considered that, mate. You know, and it seems like all about trying to improve efficiencies, and if you've never been in the brewing industry or if you've not had your own brewery before, it's understanding all these little industry tricks of how you can maximize the amount of brews that you get. And so you're not brewing every single day, you can maximize it in one brew day. And, you know, I always thought, well, if I've only got a 1,000-liter system, you know, and I'm only doing one brew a day, I've only getting 1,000 liters done in that day. But what you're saying is you could probably do a triple batch in a 10, 12 hour period, and there's 3,000 liters there. So that's a massive way of improving your efficiencies and output, I guess.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're probably going to get that onto later. So that could also link back to your fermentation tanks as well. So what I usually say is like have some single tanks and have some double tanks. And then, you know, in that day, you mean you could actually, if you can do three brews a day, you could be doing the, in your biggest cellar, and then still do 500 liters of another beer at the end of the day, and then you fill your tanks. I mean, when people first get into brewing, they just think, oh, all I do is brew beer. But that's honestly not a lot of your work week isn't actually making beer. As I say, it's mostly cleaning kegs, cellaring, filtering. There's so much other to do. If you can try and get as much of your brewing done in one particular day and just get it finished so you can concentrate on the other stuff, then, you know, I would recommend it. So when it comes to designing a brewery, so kind of think about how you can add more flexibility into the system.
Some absolute great advice and content there about all the different vessel setups. A lot of things that I never even considered in the optimization and I guess efficiency side of maximizing your brew days. So I'm sure the audience will take a lot from that. But are you able to give us some of your opinions on I guess some of the top of the range systems out there, some best value systems, and maybe some systems for people that are on really tight budgets? Because I know there's a lot of people here that have hit me up about, you know, more shoestring type brewery advice, you know, maybe the nano or micro brewery people. So are you able to give us a few comments about those?
Yeah, I mean, you can start a brewery pretty much on any budget, and there's always something out there for wherever you start. And if you have to start small, it's all good, it's all fine. But yeah, I mean, obviously when you get to the top of the range stuff, it can get pretty crazy out there. I mean, I did a short stint working for AB InBev in China, and a lot of those brewers, they don't physically touch much of the brewing equipment. They're just looking at computer screens and they're touching buttons. I mean, you'll have pressure sensors, which will tell them how full the, even for like the kettle and whatnot. And then also they all have internal calandrias. So that's basically, they have like a, I suppose it looks a little bit like a mushroom that's inside there, and it's like internal steam heating. And that gives a really good vigorous boil. In these really big breweries, they're after a really big vigorous boil, and they're literally looking at the screen and the screen saying how big, how vigorous their boil is, which I think I was speaking to you earlier about this. I still have a hard time just reading what's actually on the screen. I'm still going to have a go and look. I think it's because of my background working on smaller breweries. But yeah, I mean, they even have like internal real time being able to read the gravities of the beer. They can literally just look on the screen and see what gravity is. I bet that's out of the range of most people when they're starting out. As we said, when we were talking earlier, we're talking about the minimum amount of equipment that you need to start and then have your opportunity to add to it.
And Neil, I guess what our audience also are interested in hearing about is some of the more better value for money or people on tight budgets systems out there on the market. Are you able to share some thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. So if you're on a tighter budget, just kind of going back to an earlier conversation, start with the two vessel system, mash tun, outer tun, kettle, whirlpool. And as I say, give yourself a chance. Hopefully when you're successful and there's a bit more running capital, give yourself the option to add whatever. But if you can stretch your budget a little bit more, I would always try and add a little bit of automation into your system. The two I would really recommend, it's mostly to do with mashing in and then controlling your temperatures for your mash. Because you can do like an infusion mash, like a single in mash where you're only just going in at one temperature, say like 63, 64 for a lager or 68 for an ale. But like some of the more traditional brews that you do, like for a wheat beer, like in China, as I was saying, Hefei 50%, if you can start lower, like and do a what we call a protein rest, it kind of helps later on with your sparge. Because what you'll find is if you're using lots more kind of different adjuncts rather than like pure malt, you can actually have trouble with the water going through the mash bed and then going on. But if you can control your mash depth, so if you can have somewhere where you have a little control panel, or even it can just be like one little control unit, and then you can go through and do step mashes, maybe going up to 52 or 63 and then up to 72. A, you can make beer that's truer to style, and it'll actually end up probably with sort of better quality beer, I think, over time. And then the other thing is, if you can control by pressing a button or there's some kind of readout that you can use where you can control the temperature of the water that's going into your mash, and then also the temperature your mash water is going in, it just kind of takes the stress off, because otherwise when you're doing it manually, there's always a little bit of guesswork involved, because you're like, okay, what's the temperature outside today? What's the temperature of my, you know, of my tank? Do I need to preheat it? And sometimes it's quite hard to reach your target mesh temperature. So if you can control the temperature of your mash water going in, the overall mash, and then even if it's slightly lower, you've got the ability to press a button to bring it up to your target mash temperature. It's not a much more significant investment. You can actually do it quite simply. But if you can do that, I'd really recommend it. Otherwise, there's nothing wrong. You can do it with the very simple equipment. But, you know, think about where your budget. At the end of the day, what makes you stand out is your beer quality. So if you can do little things without having a larger investment that you think will increase your beer quality, and then brewing day you have to constantly be looking at it, and if you can add some kind of automatic control, obviously you still need to check it, but you can kind of rely on the control unit to help out. So like as soon as you've mashed in, after 5 minutes you want to check the pH, or you have to get your fermenter ready. If you have a problem when you're cleaning your fermenter and then you forgot, I forgot to take the temperature up, you know what I mean, by 10 minutes. But if you know the computer's already done that for you, it kind of takes the stress out of the day, and then you can concentrate on other elements as well as hopefully producing better beer.
So basically where you're seeing that extra money go towards your system is more automation, really.
Yep. I mean, these are like the cheapest bits of automation, because we were talking about having inline like gravity checks inside your FE. Obviously you don't need that, but there's a couple of simpler things that are not too much more expensive, that if you can do that, I think it will A, make your brew life easier, also allow your beer to be more consistent, because you'll have your recipe, then you'll be like, okay, 20 minutes at 44, 20 minutes at 52, 40 minutes at 60, you know, and then you'll know that you're hitting that exactly the same time between different batches that you're doing. Even on smaller systems, when you're on a budget, they're always going to be, you know, you're not going to have 100% from one beer to the next. And I actually think customers sometimes like that little bit of variance, but you don't want it to be the variables to be too big. The customer still expects a certain beer, if they regulars, to be a particular taste all the time. And those little simple bits of automation will allow you to reach that consistency much easier and allow you to be able to do other jobs. Because as you know, being a brewer yourself, you're not doing one job at a time. You're usually doing three jobs in at a time. If you can have a little bit of automation to give you time to do the other stuff, it's definitely pays for itself.
Mm. What it's sounding like, if you pay for good automation, it's almost like paying for another staff
member. An extra person.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you're starting out and you're on a budget and maybe you can't afford any other staff, if you design your brewery well and you can still keep within your budget, but then, you know what I mean? It allows you to multitask a little bit better and then not have to worry too much about always being there to check the brewery every 5 minutes.
Yeah. So Neil, what advice would you give aspiring brewery owners who have, they've worked out their location, they've worked out what sort of brewery or concept their brewery is, and they're at that stage of starting to engage with manufacturers and suppliers, either here in Australia or overseas in China or Asia? You know, they're looking at sourcing some quotes or potentially going overseas and looking at equipment. Are you able to give us a bit of insight about what you would recommend to those brewery or aspiring brewery owners?
Sure. It's always research. And if you do already have people in the trade that are willing to chat with you, go and speak to other people that obviously have gone through this whole process before you. Because a lot of breweries or a lot of brewery owners are willing to chat to other people. I mean, especially in Asia, because it's the whole rising tides, you know, lifts up all boats. So go and research, speak to lots of people, and that will probably give you a list of a number of manufacturers that you recommend. And it would quickly show you which manufacturers probably are not worth going to, because, you know, there's a few people out there that have had pretty bad experiences. And then it's a question of going off and then visiting these different equipment manufacturers, pick out 3 to 5, go over there, because any reputable manufacturer will be happy to let you visit their facility. You know, you can spend the day there, you can have a look at their equipment, you can see what they're doing, what the whole processes are. And then, you know, you're looking at things like how the welds go. And then, also ask for these manufacturers to give you contacts with other people that have been using their breweries, and then go and chatting with them and see how that equipment's worked for them. How is it holding up? If there were a few issues, you know, where were the issues? If you could make certain changes to the brewery, what would you do? And then that would probably A, give you a list of 3 people to then probably get a tender from, start looking at quotes. And then when it comes to the actual designing of the brewery, you probably end up with certain bits of information about your whole brewery setup, like little things about, you know, maybe like the oxygenation point, or do you have a 1-stage heat exchanger, or do you need a 2-stage heat exchanger? And then you'll get quotes from these guys, and then looking at different quotes and knowing how good their equipment is, it will probably give you a good idea of who to pull the trigger with and make that order.
So Neil, what are some of the common mistakes that you've seen or heard of by brewery owners in the sourcing equipment stage?
Yeah, I get this time and time again. Brewers usually just start out too small, and you want to be successful, so why not plan for that from the start? You know, I would never start with less than a 500-litre system, if I'm being honest. And as I said again, I would go up to 1,000 liters for some of the other tanks for the biggest sellers. So think about it. And then you also have the opportunity, even if you are larger and you think, oh, I can't brew it, if you have the right system installed, is nothing to say you can do like 200 to 300 liters in smaller batches of some of the stuff you're not selling. But it's better to go larger now, because actually buying a difference between a 300 liter system and a 500 liter system, it's not a lot of money, because you're still paying for the same machinery. You're just paying for the extra stainless steel to be able to make it. So you may be talking 10-15% increase in costs. Now, if you start with a 300 liter brewery and then you soon realize you needed a 10 hectoliter brewery, you're going to spend a lot of money. But if you maybe went for the 500 liter brewery, you still have the ability to do 10 hectoliters. Also, make sure you have enough cold storage space. Even if you're going to be a brew pub and you're doing serving tanks, you don't want to keep those serving tanks half empty. Once it gets to a certain point, you want to get that beer off and then start filling it again. Good tip is, I would say, even for most breweries, I have as much keg like volume space as you would for your cellaring space for your fermenters and your bright tanks. Yeah, those are the couple of the things that people kind of overlook. It's just not give themselves a capacity, because a lot of people are usually surprised that the amount of volume you'll end up going through, or how much physical space like beer takes up once you start putting beer through the system in each individual tank, and then obviously to be able to dispense it as well.
Yeah, and that is, I guess, seems to be a common theme with a number of the guests I've either had on, or even through my own research of, you know, podcasts and information out there on the net, is people, when they saying what would they do differently, they would have started out much bigger, because one, they didn't take into account the demand and interest for their beer, and they got overwhelmed in the first 12 months and just couldn't produce enough to satisfy all the thirsty beer drinkers there in their local area or wherever, and they just wish they started out bigger in the start. And I guess that comes down to, well, probably the biggest reason is capital and their budget. But like you're saying, if you can justify the cost and you can find that extra money, going bigger from the very beginning would make things a lot easier for you in the first sort of couple of years, because I'm seeing people doing bloody 14, 17 hour days trying to do triple batches on a real raw system that's not very automated, almost homebrew, backyard homebrewing level. I definitely don't want to be doing that. I think my wife would kill me if I'm doing those sort of days. I think the love of brewing and actually doing the business would drive you insane and actually not make it as fun for you. I think you'd burn out really quickly.
Yeah, mate. I've actually, when I've been a job in brewer, I've actually ended up working some of those systems, and my wife has joked, are you married to the brewery or are you married to me? Because I've ended up having to spend such a long time there. Yeah, as I say, and even if you go larger with your system, it's not ideal to have smaller systems, but even if you have a 500 liter system and you decide to have a couple of 250 liter tanks, you know, that means you, some of your smaller sellers at the start, you know, you can just do smaller batches and still sell them. But once you get bigger, it also is another way. You can still do that 500 liters, split it to two batches, maybe use different yeasts or add two different adjuncts. And then you still have the flexibility to have interesting things on your tap. Still use the original equipment that you've bought. But, you know, if you go larger, you can always fill the smaller systems or smaller tanks. But then when you do get successful, you still have the ability to get throughput of beer without having to outlay too much money. So you always just want to, at the start, think about flexibility. Try and give yourself as much flexibility to be able to have your core beers, maybe have a few extra beers for specials that you're rotating all the time, but then give yourself the ability when you're successful to be able to go on to the next stage without having to have too big a capital investment that's eating into your running capital.
Yeah, great advice. And I think we might have touched on it a little bit earlier on in our conversation, but are you able to go through some of the important physical considerations when it comes to someone's brewery, you know, the location they've found? I hear a lot of people talk about, you know, making sure you've got enough footprint and brewery space to put your brewery and your tap room and all that. So that's a consideration. And, you know, I think the guys from The Rocks, Simon and Addy, they talked about, look at the height of your ceilings. Can you fit, you know, your tanks in there, or a pallet of cans, you know, through the through the dock door or something, you know. So are you able to talk a bit about some of those important physical brewery considerations?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the first things is, once you decide a brewery, make sure you leave the space to actually, when you physically want to deliver the brewery, you can actually get it in. So if you're doing a brew pub or a brewery, the first thing to do is get that brewery in. So like, for example, I was just working on an install recently in Yunnan in China. Now, 3 months before the actual tap room was open, the brewery was in, and they started doing all the brews before the tap room is open. So when they're open, you know, most of their kegs were full and most of their tank space was full, because when you have that initial rush, you're going to sell quite a lot of beer because you're the new guy in town. And what you don't want is just to have no beer and then you have to close for 2 weeks. I've heard breweries having to close for 2 weeks as soon as they opened, and they've lost that initial enthusiasm for their stuff.
Yeah.
Now, as a consultant, I talk with a lot of breweries and then we try and find out how to best use the space that they have. I've actually seen a brewery where they had a 2-hectoliter system where they managed to fit it into, I think it would have been about a 25 square meter room. And they actually had their steam system in there as well. And like their water filtration system was like 2.5 meters off the ground. So, you know, if you can, that's what I'm saying. If you're really new and you don't know too much about brewing, it might be worth bringing on a consultant, because you can actually get, if you have like ceiling heights and you don't have floor space, you can actually get a manufacturer to make what we call like thinner fermenting vessel. So it'll take up height rather than floor space. So you can fit more tanks in a smaller space, or you can actually have stacked fermenters. So like you can have like 500 liter stacked fermenters. So you have one fermenter on top of the other, but that would mean you'd probably need like 5 meters of height. And I'm guessing a lot of people, but there is a lot of flexibility in the system. So the more planning you do before you actually purchase a system, you can find something that can fit into most spaces these days. It's just having a good relationship with the equipment supplier. I mean, most people say around for every 100 liters of brew length, have at least 10 square meters of floor space. That's a good estimate to start with. I mean, it's not ideal, but think about that first, and that will give you an idea of how much floor space you'll need for the actual physical brewery, not including obviously storage. And then if you have the possibility, if you can have some of your machinery outside, if for like your chillers, for your cold storage, potentially for your steam machine and other stuff, because that stuff can get quite noisy and it takes up a lot of space and actually can build up a lot of heat. If you do have a little bit of outside space, it can really help you to make sure you're using the best internal space to basically make money and have enough space for your selling area.
I know that I've heard a lot of considerations into drainage and what type of floors as well. Can your brewery floor hold the weight of the brew house going in? Are you able to share some comments around that?
Yeah, I mean, there's usually quite a lot of people involved in getting a brewery up and running. You can have your equipment manager and then just bring on a good designer. And you're going to have a contractor come in to get the building ready for this. And as long as you get somebody that's reputable in, you can get the weight of the tank, and then you can get the weight of the tank full of liquid. And then you just make sure that your contractor is aware of this and make sure they have the proper load to be able to do that. Find a good contractor really. And if you're in the trade, I'm sure most people will be able to find somebody to help them with that. And then when it comes to drainage, you will get a lot of brewers. I mean, people on some brewing forums, people post up their drainage pictures, and a lot of people are like, you can get drain envy. But every liter of beer you make, you're probably going to get through a minimum of 5 liters of water. You need to be able to handle that amount of drainage. And then most people have trench drains that go along a length of the brew house. So wherever you're going to use water, you really want to have one. So you're going to have some in your brew house, underneath your actual physical brew house. Then you want a nice good trench drain that goes through your cellar space. And then even like if you're having steam, you need an area for the steam sometimes to drain out the water and the steam. So yeah, drainage is really important. You can't have too much drainage. Never go with like central drain spots, because you'll end up spending an hour of your day just pushing water from one place to another. I can't remember the figure offhand. Maybe we can add that to the notes of the podcast later on. But yeah, if you can have a slight, what's the word? Slope to your brew house. If you're going to go into a new site, if you can have a slight slope going into your drains, that will really help you later on. I've worked in breweries where they've ended up having dead spaces, and then you know, you can spend a couple of hours of your day just pushing water with a squeegee, which isn't much fun at all, because there's enough to be going on with for sure.
And just on floors, because we haven't spoken a whole lot about it. I had the, just quoting the guys from the Rocks again, about things that they would love to have when starting out. They talked about epoxy floors. Sometimes they're not, I guess it depends on what supplier you get or what type of epoxy floor, but you know, they were talking about brewer tiles and you know, like petrified tiles. They seem to be regarded as, you know, the bee's knees when it comes to tiling or brewery floors in the brewing industry. I know that a lot of people talk about epoxy floors, but you know, then there's also flaws with that as well, depending on how well it's applied and what type of epoxy it is. Where people are saying it, you know, acids over time will eat away at it and it'll start peeling and getting under it. So yeah, I want to talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's two choices, the tiles that you were speaking about, and a lot of people go with epoxy floors. Usually one of area of problems is where the epoxy floor meets the drain, depending on who you're speaking to, because with that point, there might be, if it's not done properly, you can actually get cracks, and then the water can get underneath or around, and eventually it starts eroding or breaking away. And also, if you get the wrong type, I mean, I don't know the different types off the top of my head, but you can start to discolor, because obviously you're using different chemicals on the floor. And then if you're doing a CIP, like if you have the wrong type of epoxy floor and you use an acid, you can actually, I worked at one brewery that I went into and it looked like they had tobacco stains everywhere on the floor, because the way the acid that goes in, and when you spent thousands of dollars to put it down, it's really kind of heartbreaking to see it. So again, that's also doing your research, like with your local suppliers, whichever country you've been in. And then similar with the manufacturers, if you find a supplier that you think's good, if they've had people that have gone and put it into other breweries, speak with them. This is why I like being in brewing. It's a really good community, and stuff like this, people are usually willing to share their information when it comes to this stuff. So just try and speak to as many people as possible, you know, go on the regular forums. People are usually on there and they can tell you, and then they will tell you like local suppliers also, the best places to go for trench drains. And even if you're really, really new, some people will even tell you about depth and things like that. And then, yeah, I mean, if you really don't have too much budget, I've seen people use like treated concrete. I mean, that's probably the cheapest you can go with. But again, you want to make sure it's treated properly, because again, acid can eat into and slowly start eroding away your concrete as well. So yeah, there's a few options out there. It's just depending on your budget, what you can go for. But you know, the right type of concrete foundation could be good enough. I mean, most people, when they start a brewery, you end up having, even if you have a floor, most of them have to reset it and lay a new concrete. So you're physically raising your floor to then actually put the lay in the trench drains as well, because obviously that's the first place you start. So when it comes to your drainage, you have your building, and then you'll have your equipment. And once you have your equipment, a manufacturer will be able to work with you to where everything will be placed. And then you can decide where your trench drains need to be. Actually, at this point, I'd also say, think about your utility points as well. Mm. So where your three phase needs to be, where your water outlets are going to be, and you know, where the steam's going to go in, where your lines for your cold storage, where it's coming from the chiller to go in. This is a really good time before you do any work on the actual internals of the building. Make sure everything's laid out, including the drains. And then whilst the equipment's being fabricated, your contractors can come in, and then everybody knows exactly where the drains need to be, where the PowerPoint's B2B, and then it will just make for a completely smoother installation rather than having to work on the fly. And then it'll even cost you more money because you might end up having to dig up some of the floor you've laid or something else. If you plan it enough in advance, you can even actually lay a lot of your electricals under the floor, and then you can actually put a lot of the wire, you'll have a plastic, PET tubes, and you can lay onto the top, and then you can actually put a lot of the electrics actually underneath the floor, because it will go through those pipes and go to different places rather than have it above ground, which I've done in a couple of installations, and it works out really well. It means your solenoid valves, the solenoid valves are for regulating the temperatures on fermenters. It tells you when the cooling should switch in and off. I actually had one brewery where each pipe where it came out for the fermenter, the lines to go into the solenoids came in, and it just made it much neater and easier to switch out, and less chance of breaking a line or catching a line. So, it's really important to plan properly at the start, because it will save you time and make you more efficient down the line.
Mate, I feel like my head's just exploded.
I felt like I was rambling there, but once you start.
No rambling at all, mate. If anyone's calling that rambling, then they need their head rung. But I can't say anyone on a podcast, or anyone for that matter, giving away free information, is delivering stuff like what you've just delivered, mate, because people pay top dollar to hear that. And that's why I'm going to make sure people are giving you a call when they're looking at sourcing equipment overseas. So, mate, you definitely know your stuff, and you've given me so many things to think about. You know, just when I'm a few episodes in talking to people that already have their brewery, and then, talking to someone like yourself, you seem to have all the, from your experience, you've just, going all over things that people are not considering when starting out. Like, I've heard stories of people here in Australia where they haven't even considered, the floor drains. I've seen breweries where concrete is being eaten away, where they've got central drain points, and, not even looking at the power side. They don't even have three-phase power, or don't have enough power to power their brew house because they weren't thinking about it in the beginning.
Yep.
They're paying for it down the track once it's in, and it's costing them a lot more money to sort of operate. So it doesn't sound sexy, but it's so important.
Yeah, as I say, one of the things, when I'm doing a location, can I get the right power to it? Because you'll find a lot of residential areas, they don't have the chance to get three phase in, and it can cost a whole lot of money to get three phase. So if you can't get three phase, just knock that place on the head. Even if it's a beautiful location and you think it's got really good through traffic, it's not worthwhile. It really isn't. A lot of people say I give away a lot of good information, but it's just I like to help fellow brewers. I'm giving that information away, and I've also got a lot of other information. If people come to me, I can help them with a lot of other stuff. And it's a brewing community, and especially where I am in China, it's still pretty new, and I just like to try and help out people to get them to a certain level, because it helps us all. It's getting better now, but there's still beer that's not particularly good, and isn't it? They only need to make a few changes to up it. And then if the regular person's come in and they have a bad experience with craft beer, because it's slightly more than domestic, it's a higher price, it might put them off going to craft beer in the future, and that's killing the industry for everybody. I'm happy to share information to it, just because we're all in it together to a certain extent, so it's all good.
Well, just advice to you, Neil, don't give away too much or you put yourself out of a job, mate.
Well, I am holding certain things back.
Yeah, all good, mate. I guess last question of this segment, and mate, you've dived into some great information, and I'd like to get your take on industry insights, both in Asia, and if you know anything about the Australian market for that matter, or other countries. But are you able to rattle off a couple trustworthy or reliable manufacturers or suppliers in China or Asia that, maybe some go-tos for you? I don't know if you want to share with the audience. Don't have to go into too much depth, just maybe a short list of some of those.
There's a few, but as I say, it changes all the time. What might be reputable now, you don't know further down the line, but there's a couple. A big shout out to Bespoke Brewing Solutions in China. He's an old friend of mine, but there's three people in the team. One of them is an ex-brewer and from the UK that's worked in some of the big breweries. Another guy that's really good with the fabrication of equipment. And the third one is a IBD brewer. IBD is the it's where you can get your degree in brewing back in UK. And if you've got that, you're actually to a very good level. I mean, they know what they're talking about and they've got all the bases covered. When you come into China, there's two places actually where most of the equipment's made, Jinan in Shandong and then Ningbo, which is quite close to Shanghai. And in general, the equipment made in Ningbo is of a higher standard, but you're paying a lot more for it. And you can actually get pretty good equipment made in Jinan. And there's quite a lot, there's quite a few there. But, you know, if people want to help, yeah, they can, you know, as I say later on, you can reach out to me. I've got a few people that I would definitely recommend and help people make introductions if they ever want to purchase equipment in China for sure.
Yeah, perfect, mate. Well, yeah, that's a good little list for people to start with. So just moving on, industry insights, and prior to us getting on here, I know you shared a lot of information and notes about, you know, your take on the industry. And I'd like to hear from you about any new and exciting equipment actually coming onto the market to, you know, to improve automation and improve efficiencies. I know in some of your notes, you mentioned some pretty exciting stuff. Are you able to share that with some of the audience?
Yeah. When I saw recently, I can't remember the name of the company. It calls itself the Alcoholizer. So as you know, the when you're making like non-alcohol beer, it's actually harder to make because it's easier for you to pick up an infection. So if you can take the alcohol, strip the alcohol further along in the process, it makes the chance of infection lower. So this Alcoholizer by this American company, you put in the beer you've made, and then it will give you the non-alcohol beer that goes into one tank, and it apparently still has all the flavor. And then you end up with like 8% alcohol that goes into another tank. So basically it splits it, which is really cool because now, as you know, hard seltzers are really starting to enter the market. I know in the US with White Claw, it's pretty big. Mm. They've got a few in China now that are looking into it. There's one just launched in Shanghai recently. So that you could use that as alcohol to flavor it to have other products like hard seltzer and stuff. And then you end up with non-alcoholic beer, whichever style you want, IPA or whatever. And because it's only being split as it's going into the packaging tank, as soon as if you're packaging that pretty much straight away, the chances of getting infection are decreased because you're not have to do it all the way through the process and the fermentation. So yeah, that's a pretty cool piece of equipment. And the other thing is, I mean, a lot of people know about hot rockets now. Now a lot of people have reverse engineered it, and you can actually get a decent hop rocket for not too much money. And that can really help with dry hopping because you don't end up with too much vegetable hop material in the tank. It stays in the hop rocket itself. And instead of being a 3-4 day thing to dry hop, because you're putting the hops in there and waiting then to get the aroma, it's actually a 1 day thing within five or six hours.
Is that, Neil, like what you call a hop back, is it, where basically you're talking about in the fermenting stage or both, both in the brew?
It's a post-fermentation usually.
Yeah.
That you're doing it. So the most people have dual-purpose tanks. So the tank is for the fermentation and also for the maturation, like towards the end, the fermentation. Some people like to do it after fermentation's finished. Some brewers like to do it just before, a couple of points above final fermentation. So basically, somebody described it to me, and it's kind of hard to picture. So it's like a DE filter. So it's a tank with a candle inside. Now you put the hops around the outside of the candle, and then the beer goes into the hop rocket, which is like from a 50-liter to a 200, 300-liter tank. So the beer goes in there, and then it mixes with the hops, and then it goes through the candle. So the beer goes back in the tank, and then the hops are still in the hop rocket. And then you run that for a cycle for a minimum of 3 hours up to 5-6 hours. And then that will give you all your hop aroma that you need in 1 day rather than being a 3 or 4 day thing. And then at the same time, it just means you get less beer losses because like for every kilo of dry hopping you do, I think you lose about 5 liters of beer. You just end up with less and you just end up with greater yields. And then obviously you're not dumping out lots of hot material over a period of time. You do get some that goes in, but it's minimal. And it just means you can get the beer through the process quicker, and it's really nice. You can get really nice aromas from it. And then if you have the right hop rocket, you can actually use 20 to 30% less hop loads than traditional methods as well.
Yeah,
so it's a new piece. Well, it's not that new, but it's only recently become into the reach of smaller brewers because people have reverse engineered these things, and they're coming in down in price. I think I can get one 25,000 RMB. So I don't know what that is in US dollars for one that like 20 kilos. So it's not a really large outlay. You know what I mean? And then if it increases your time of getting beer through the system and then leads to less beer loss, it soon pays for itself. Again, that project down in Dali, in Kunming in Yunnan, they were pretty skeptical about buying one. It was like, I'm going to buy either a DE filter, a diatomous earth filter, which is just basically from clearing the beer from your fermenter that goes into your bright tank, so you have clear beer to package into keg or bottle or can, or this. And I was like, this hop rocket, it's just good because it'll how quickly you can get the beer through the system, so you can get fresher dry hop beers to market quicker than you can. So yeah, I would recommend a hop rocket if you can afford one. It's good to have one, and they start with like 50 liters and go up to any size. I think we had one when I was in Armenia that can take 250 kilos of hops. It's pretty insane.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you're using 250 liters of hops and you're losing maybe up to 5 liters at a time by dry hopping method, you can see how you can claim your money back quite quickly if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear a lot of people, I know it was Neil Cameron talking about Source Brewing, or saying one of the breweries here in Sydney, the amount of hops they were using in some of their beers, it was ridiculous, the amount of kilos. And I can just imagine, yeah, how much vegetal matter is going to be in those beers, in the tanks, and how much beer loss. I don't know if they use something like that, like a hop rocket. But yeah, once again, it's spending that money to then save money down the track.
Yep.
Yeah, it's that old chestnut.
I mean, the whole thing about investment, it's always the same. Because it's scary business to get into because it's a big capital investment initially. And it's kind of scary. You brew it, people coming, you know. So, but there's certain things I would always suggest that can help you that will hopefully all pay back for itself if you have the opportunity to get those extra little bits of equipment.
Mm. And in your notes that you sent me, you mentioned about, you would love a dream visit to a brewery. I'm not sure whereabouts. Potentially
Anton
in Europe.
Paar.
Anton
Paar. In Austria.
Austria, yeah.
So Anton Paar, they've been making like equipment for measuring different parameters in brewing for a couple of hundred years. It's always actually, funny enough, it's actually, if I remember rightly, it's always been in the family. But then the actual family decided not to sell it. But now pretty much all the profit actually, they've all made enough money, and they're pretty much most of the profits now go to charity, from what I've heard. Somebody was telling me it's actually a pretty cool system or a cool company. And so they make different things like measuring the O2 in your beer, in your finished beer, because obviously oxygen in your final beer is really not your friend. That's where if you go into a bar and you have a beer and it tastes like wet cardboard, it's because at some point in the process, they've allowed too much oxygen into the beer and it's a really bad off flavor. And then you can measure very accurately the sugar content of your beer and then also your CO2 content. Because obviously if you're packaging your beer, you want it to be pretty close to your target. So depending on what beer you're doing, maybe like 2.5 grams to 2.7 grams of CO2 for every 100 grams. I don't know what you use in Australia. That's what I find when I'm traveling around. People use different measurements. So hopefully most people in Australia understand when I use that term.
No. We've had people on the show talk about DO meters, like dissolved oxygen meters, and measuring how much is going in and all that. So I think a lot of people are familiar with it or have a basic understanding. Yeah.
So yeah, this brewery, Anton Paar put a brewery and they put all of their equipment in line so it can read everything on a computer, and I've always wanted. I've got an open invitation to go. I've always wanted to go because it just sounds, as I said to you, like a brewer's wet dream.
Yeah,
it
sounds like a Willy Wonka factory or something.
Exactly.
You know?
It'd be like, I've reached the top of the mountain. Like you can, I can die here. I've seen it now. I've seen Nirvana. So yeah, because you know, I started out on smaller breweries. You know, I was mashing in by hand and you know, working for ABI and hearing about this equipment. I've seen what's out there. Like Little Creatures in Australia, I've heard their system. I think, are they in Perth?
They're probably regarded as the origin of craft beer in Australia, actually.
But their system, I worked with a brewer that worked with them, and he was telling me their system, they spent quite a lot of money on it. I've heard it's a good, fun system to work on. So hopefully one day I can visit them too. But yeah, they've actually made strides into Asia. You actually can get Little Creature in Shanghai, Hong Kong.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. So they're pretty well known in Asia as well. I think, yeah, as you say, they're one of the first people to do it. So, you know, Chinese people or people in Asia, you know, it was quite an easy, achievable target to start shipping it across. So I think they were one of the first people to start coming across to sell craft beer to China.
Yeah, they were definitely pioneers over here in Australia. They were, I think it was the early 2000s, they sort of, you know, you started hearing about them, and craft beer scene here in Australia has gone from strength to strength, but they were probably one of the early boys that sort of sparked it all,
yep,
in my opinion.
Yeah. So in Asia in general, it's really starting to take off. And you're seeing like breweries open up in locations you'd never expect to see them. I've seen in the last year and a half, 18 months, two different 20 hectoliter projects that gone into Bali, which is pretty big for an island. Maybe it's to cater for some of those thirsty Australians that were going across. Who knows?
Because well, I know of it's us,
quite
mate.
A big. And then even in other parts of Asia, like in Laos, in Vietnam, there's a couple of well-established craft breweries. One of them being Pasta Steep Brewing, and they started to be recognized internationally. And I think they've won some like international World Beer Cup medals, and it's slowly starting to happen elsewhere. One of the biggest more established is in South Korea, and yeah, they've also had a few that have medaled. There's what's it called, Great Waves? Maybe I'll have to add that to the notes as well. And they're just purely making sour beer. It's just a whole sour beer facility in Asia. And even five years ago, that would almost be impossible. There was just no market for sour beers back then. It's taken quite a while for even hoppy beers to be liked over in Asia. So a lot of the brewers in Asia that work are expat brewers. So they're from America, Germany, Europe, and the UK. So it was kind of educating the customers as they were brewing. So that's why Hefeweizen is still quite popular in many parts of Asia. But then you start off with maybe a pale ale, and then I like pale ale, and it's like, okay, we crank this up to an IPA, then a full IPA, and then you can start to maybe go into the more malty side, and then you end up with imperial stouts or whatever. So the market is opening up as people become more educated, and also you will find a lot of Asians are starting to be educated outside of Asia. So they're going across, they're drinking these beers, and then when they're coming back, they want to have these beers that they've drank elsewhere locally and make locally made.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like a tier system. Like China is further along in its development, but then you maybe go to Thailand or places like that, and it's, you know, they're still at IPA stage rather than having too many sour beers. Mm. So it's really, really interesting what's happening. And yeah, I'm quite fascinated to see how it will proceed in the future. What I'd like to see coming up is, like, for now, the Asian craft brewers to start having their own voice. I mean, we have access to lots of like different ingredients that are unique to the area, like fruits or, you know, fruits or different adjuncts that you can use, or slightly different barleys, grains that can be used. So, I mean, there's not really been a style that's come out that you can say it's typically Asian. I mean, like even in Brazil, if you've heard of Catarina Sours, they slowly start, and basically it's like sour fruit beers, because like in the Amazon, they have some crazy fruits. So they're making some really interesting beers, and you are now starting to see American breweries make Catarina sours, but there's an opportunity for brewers in Asia with some of the ingredients open to them to now, you know, put their own stamp on it. I really like to see some, maybe CPA, Chinese pale ale, or, you know what I mean? Or sour beer using some kind of local fruits. Or I think that's, people have got to a level where they're kind of confident they can do the main style as well. And now it's using the knowledge they've gained and then looking at what's available to locally and make something else. That's really where I think the excitement is going to be in the Asian craft beer scene. And talking to some of my buddies, they're starting to go into that thought category. So hoping in the next year or two, we'll start seeing some interesting beers coming out that are unique, that will spread and other people will like them and maybe even start copying them in other parts of the world.
Mm. And how are you coping with COVID over in Asia when it comes to, you know, your line of work and getting equipment into the, supply and demand for equipment? I'm sure over here in Australia, I know that trying to get stuff from China is a bit of a taboo at the moment, but how is it for you guys over there?
I mean, obviously I'm in the equipment sourcing. That's my main area where I help out clients. So yeah, it's not been easy because obviously everybody's holding off because either their markets are shut because pubs are shut or whatever. I mean, like in the UK now, speaking to my friends back there, they've just had a second lockdown and it's pretty brutal. I can see a lot of breweries are going to go out of business, unfortunately. It's really kind of sad. From my point of view, yeah, people are interested, but they're like, we want to find out about pricing and whatnot, but we're going to wait till at least the summer of next year before we're going to purchase. So yeah, I guess within China, we kind of got over COVID. So right now I'm kind of just helping people within China start up breweries. As I said, I was just working with a client for 6 months down in Yunnan. So mostly it's just helping people, making connections right now for hopefully the summer to be able to purchase equipment when people know, you know, obviously the vaccines is going to come in. So hopefully people will start begin back to normal in the future. So yeah, it has affected me, but I'm kind of positive that 2021 will hopefully allow people to start get back to normal. And what I've seen actually is in China itself, it's the people that have been successful are the ones that took this time to assess their business models and then look at how, when it started open again, how best they could get back into the market and really be healthy or come back with a bang, as it were. So like, for example, my really good friend, David at Fat Fat Beer Horse in Xiamen, he has a distillery as well, a crafted distillery. So what he decided was he was going to take his vodka and instead of put it into bottles, he started to put it into 5-liter containers. That would bring down the price per liter. And that made it more attractive for people that wanted to buy craft distilled gin that were in higher end bars. And he found that people were more willing to buy the five liter volumes. A, they were buying cheaper and obviously meant they could make more profit. So we're just looking at people looking at their real business model and then looking like, okay, we've got a couple of months where we've slowed down. We can't make as much, but what can we do? What can we do when we get back to the brewery?
Mm. Distilling seems to be a growing trend here in Australia as well, actually. You know, you've seen a lot more gin distilleries. And so that is actually a thing that has interested me as well. I've had a couple of people contact me about, you know, that they're listening to this podcast, interested to sort of try apply to the distilling side because there is some similarities in transferable sure. stuff. So I guess that's one thing for people to look into as well. I guess we've definitely gone over time, Neil, and I guess when I say we've gone over time, I don't really have a set limit, but I guess I'll try to keep it to an hour. People seem to be sure. like to digest things in an hour podcast, but for those that are really keen, I'm sure they'll be interested in just tuning in for as long as the content's worthy to be heard. But any closing thoughts and advice you'd like to give our listeners on what we've discussed?
Yeah, I mean, just take the time to really plan out what do you want to achieve, where you want to be in 2, 3, 5 years, and then think about how best you can make sure your equipment can last you those initial years Most people want to try and make sure their first brewery can last them 5 years. So if you can find, even if you don't have enough budget to start off with, just speak to people and then find out where you can add on later on down the line to, you know, to be able to do big volumes quicker without spending too much money. And then, always, as I say, plan. Just do as much work so when you have your location that you're pretty much set up so you can have the smoothest transition with your installation to work with people. And so, yeah, work with your, I don't know, if you have your architect who's also working with your contractor who's going to do the building work, with your manufacturer and yourselves, and just make sure people are in the loop. When it comes to brewing in general, communication is key, even if it's within the brewery itself. Because I've seen places where like the sales staff and the brewing staff, they don't really interact too much. Just if you're a brewery owner, just make sure everybody feels they're included in the brewery and make sure everybody understands what other people are doing. And I always say, like, always have people do follow around on other people's like day-to-day jobs. Like have your assistant brewer do a couple of days, like following the sales staff, and vice versa. The sales staff should come and do some brews and stuff, and builds teamwork, and everybody appreciates everybody's role, and it will just make for a happier environment and better business.
Yeah, well, while I've also got you on, Neil, I guess take this opportunity just to plug. I know you've talked about some of the services that you offer as your business and as a consultant, but take the time now, mate, just briefly, you know, to plug some of your services and how people can get in touch, mate.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris. So as you know, right now, it's not easy to get into China. So what I've also started to do is I offer the opportunity, if you still want to get equipment manufactured there, I can be like your man on the ground. So I can help you have a good relationship and contact with your equipment supplier, you know, be your contact on the ground, go and do factory tours. We can do video calls. I can send pictures. If you've got questions, I can answer your questions and all that kind of stuff. So I can do your initial factory tours to help you find out which equipment suppliers you might want to work with. And then once you have an equipment supplier, I can go back during fabrication, make sure there's something obviously that might be off, try and catch it earlier rather than when it's finished, because it will save a bit of money. And then obviously go again, make sure everything's good before it's signed off. So, you know, if it's hard to come into China right now, I can definitely help with that. Or even if you don't want to, or, you know, if you don't want to come, then yeah, I'm there to be, you know, I can be in contact pretty much all the time and answer your questions and put your fears at ease, help you source equipment, and then work on the whole, you know, modular system to try and get the most out of your system for a lower capital investment to start off with. So yeah, a lot of the stuff we've talked about today, I can use my expertise to work with you to try and make you as successful for the equipment purchasing as you can be. And then if you are actually within Asia, maybe not now, maybe a few months when COVID is over, I do sometimes go and help other breweries if they're having a few issues or whatever. I can come and spend a week or a month in different parts, train brewery staff, look at your different procedures that you're running, maybe make some suggestions and try and help you along the way, you know, rather than take you a year to figure something out. Maybe with some of the insights I can have, or maybe I can make it a couple of months and then you'll be up and running. And then just try and work with people and help them overcome any problems they have, or if they've got any questions. You know, I try to be as approachable as possible, as I say, without giving away all my secrets. So yeah, it's anything that touches China in general, I can generally help out with. And that can even be, I think I was telling you, I had a UK brewery that was had some Chinese people, or a Chinese company wanted to distribute their beer in China. And they wanted to contract the beer to be made in China and then sold here. So I can help with people if they want to contract brew in China and distribute it. And if I can't help personally, then I do have a network of people and I can probably point you in the right direction. So for example, these guys in China, I've got a distributor that a friend of mine, Bryant, who he looks after quite a lot of the international craft beer brands here. He works and basically helps distribute the beer all the way through China. So he's always looking for other people that might be wanting to work with him. So, you know, if I don't know somebody, I can definitely point you in the right direction.
Yeah, Excellent. And how do people get in touch, mate? I know you've got a detailed website. Do you want to point people to that?
Yeah, so it's asianbeernetwork.com. Also on Twitter, although I have to get on my VPN to be able to check that in China, but that's at Beer Asian. And my email is Neil, N-E-I-L, at asianbeernetwork.com. And a lot of people tend to just initially approach me on LinkedIn. I think if you, my name's pretty unique. If you put Neil Playfoot, P-L-A-Y-F-O-O-T, into LinkedIn, I don't think there's many people called Neil Playfoot, so you should be able to find me on there and just give me a shout out, and yeah, we can connect anytime.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Neil. You've been very generous with your time, mate. And like I said, my head is just rattling around with the amount of content you shared and things that, you know, just when I thought I was starting to work it all out, there's just another layer and next level of stuff that needs to be considered. And I know that this episode is going to go a long way in helping people on their journey. So I really thank you, mate. And, you know, maybe who knows the future of the podcast, maybe have you on, discuss a few more things in the time to come. You know, I'm sure you'll have a ton more stuff to share with people. But well, thanks again, everyone. That was Neil Playfoot from Asian Beer Network. Thanks for coming on the podcast, mate.
Thank you, Chris. And well, you have a good day. It's actually my birthday, so I'm going to go have
Right. Actually, I think I might have saw that on LinkedIn, mate. I apologize. I didn't sing you happy birthday at the beginning of the episode, mate. Well, happy birthday, mate. Well, and you were even willing to spend a couple hours with me on the podcast. So I hope that I can get you some nice referrals from this podcast for you, mate, as a nice little birthday gift for you.
Yeah, be a nice birthday present for you. So we'll see what happens. But as I say, if anybody's out there listening, as I say, yeah, just get in touch with LinkedIn. And if you've got a couple of basic questions, man, I'm, as I said, as much as possible, I can help out or at least give you access or point you in the right directions of resources, either online reading or whatever. To do actually do have another one, like a free booklet. Maybe I can give it to you and you can share it with your readers, like how to get into the brewing industry. It's a little PDF.
Yeah, we're going to have a pretty detailed website launching very soon. It's just a landing page at the moment. I want to fill it with, you know, a bit of a business directory for people for different categories of the brewing building journey. And I've promised people ebooks and all that. So, that would sound great, mate. So we'll link to a few things in the show notes, including your website and some other stuff. But yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Well, thanks again and have a good day.
Yeah, and happy birthday again, Neil. Thanks for coming on.
All right, cheers. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Build Me a Brewery podcast. That was part one of the brewery equipment sourcing segment. Part two of the segment, I chat with John Gonzalez from Bespoke Brewing Solutions. Another great episode to complement our conversation with Neil, so please tune in anytime to get acquainted. As always, if you are liking the podcast so far and find the content useful, please give us a follow and rating on whatever platform you're listening on. Also, follow us on all our social media handles, as well as visiting our website, www.buildmeabrewery.com.au. And much more complimentary content will be coming your way if you sign up to our mailing list. I'm Chris Hayton, your host, and this is the Build Me a Brewery podcast.